Dwayne Ross is the manager of astronaut candidate selection and training at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. And Peter Aylward from The Space Show, he did an interview with Dwayne at the Johnson Space Center, or was it the Kennedy Space Center, one of the two. And he began his interview by asking Dwayne how long he had been involved in astronaut selection.
I've been doing the selection piece of it since, I actually started with the 1978 class.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. So we actually started working on that class in about 1975. It takes a long time to get through a selection process and get people down here.
Okay, so from the initial advertisement to go out, what sort of time period is that?
I'll just give you, for example, this last time. This last time we put the announcement out probably in April of 2008. I'm sorry, April 2008. Our deadline was in July of 2008. We started the selection. We started reviewing applications, making some decisions. The first decisions you make is who's qualified and who's not, etc. And narrowing down the application pool, and finally started doing interviews probably in September. And interviewed September, October, November, December. And then finalized our selections probably in April of 2009 and brought the folks on board in August of 2009. So from the time you start to the time you finish, it's over a year's period of time.
Right. Yeah. And so you would coordinate physical and other types of testing with other sort of divisions within NASA, and
Absolutely.
Who would then give their scores, I suppose. Is that correct?
Yeah. Scores being a kind of a loose term. Not everything is a test, and not everything has a score. A lot of the stuff they do while they're here is medical evaluation.
Sure.
And what that is thumbs up or thumbs down.
Right.
There's no shades of gray. You either passed or you didn't.
Is that pretty much along the lines of the Air Force sort of flight?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Air Force, our FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, those kinds of things that for people who fly, airplanes. There's a few things that are different for space flight than you'd expect with people who fly airplanes, but by and large, it's very similar.
Now, looking at the current crew that's up on the space shuttle, I guess the height and shortness is not so much of a factor as it was back in the very early days?
Exactly. But they're still a factor. For the shuttle program this last time, of course, these people we just selected in 2009, we did not select the fly shuttle, because by the time we get them trained, it's going to be 2011. And we will probably be through flying the shuttle by then. So we selected them for space station, long-duration space station flights. And right now the plan is you fly to space station after the shuttle quits flying with the Russians on their Soyuz vehicle. So the anthropometrics that we had to apply to these folks were based on Soyuz, not with the...
Right, so it's kind of back to the future a little bit, because I understand the Soyuz is actually quite restricted in height. Is
not
that
as restricted as you might think. 75 and a half inches, which is fairly tall on the upper end of the scale, and of course there's down about 64 inches on the lower end of the scale. Some of that is spacecraft constraints, but some of it is spacesuit constraints. We only have two sizes of spacesuits, and one size does not fit all. Let me assure you. So you have to pick people who not only fit in the spaceship but can fit in the spacesuit.
Right. So all crews that go to the ISS would need to be able to fit into the US EVA suit. Is that
correct? That's the thought. Yeah. Not everybody that goes will do an EVA, maybe. But they may have to.
Sure.
So if they have to, then they got to fit. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And by and large, the American crews don't tend to fly or use the Russian EVA suits.
They have.
They have
sometimes.
Plan.
Yeah. It's not the plan every time. But there have been some EVAs in just the Russian suits.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they get cross training on that as part of the.
They
normal,
do.
Normal.
Part of their for their basic training, they don't get so much of that kind of training. Everybody has to, we give Russian language training to all the class that come in. But then when you get assigned to a mission, there's a couple of years of mission-specific training that you do.
Right.
And that's when you get fitted for your Soyuz seat and start training for Soyuz suit and those kinds of things.
Okay. Now, as part of the astronaut selection process, once they're selected, they go into a just generic training, and then if they get selected for a mission, it gets more specialized. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. We have a basic training curriculum that they all go through to start with, but then after that, it's just, we call it advanced training. You can call it generic training if you want, just to keep their skills up for all the things they may have to do. There's some things we don't do in basic training, some of the advanced extravehicular activity kinds of activities, robotics activities, and those kinds of things. But they do that, and then when they get assigned the mission, then you get specific about what's going to happen on that mission and what you got to know to be able to do that. A lot of the stuff you know, but the particulars for that particular mission you have to start getting up to speed on.
Okay, so when an astronaut is selected, they're employed by NASA as a government employee. Is that correct?
That is basically correct. We also take active duty military members. And so if they come into the program, they're still a member of their service for all intent and purpose. So they are detailed to NASA as astronauts. And we have an agreement with the military on how we do all of that. So when they come into the program, they're either NASA employees, government employees, or they're military employees.
Right. And are those employment contracts fixed for a fixed length, or is it they become if they come in from non-military, are they just government employees?
They're just government employees. There's okay. No contract. I'm not sure there's any legal or regulatory way you can subject a government employee to a contract. And with the military service, we have a memorandum of understanding for a specific tour of duty. But if certainly when that's up, that they're always amenable to requests for extension. So typically when somebody comes, they can stay as long as it's a benefit to NASA and the employee and into the service.
Right. So, being in charge of astronaut candidate selection training, you must have a very nice house. Sorry, that's a joke.
No, I'm a government employee too.
But everyone must be very nice to you.
You don't get rich working for the government. And if you do, the lawyers want to talk to you and
exactly.
Find out what you're up to.
That's right, Enron and all that. Yeah, yeah. I understand. This might be a delicate subject, and you please feel free not to answer if you wish.
Sure.
But were there any changes? What are your sort of reflections on the Lisa Nowak situation that eventuated, and how that reflected upon the astronaut corps, the selection process? Were there things that you got out of that changed the way you do things, or was it just one of those statistical situations?
You know, it was some of both. To think that we don't do psychological screening on people when we hire them is totally and completely wrong. A big part of the medical evaluation for years, as long as I've been doing this, has been psychological screening and psychological interviews and things like that. And obviously, the longer you go in a program, the better you know what your requirements are from a standpoint of skills needed, medical requirements, psychological requirements. And obviously, as we've been going along, we've been trying to get smarter on what it takes to do the long-duration missions. So you look for things that you might select in for, any particular traits that you might be looking for. So we had done very thorough psychological and psychiatric screenings to date. Anybody can have a bad day. Sure. Anybody can have a really bad day. And if you have a bad day, it's good not to get on television at the same time, but certainly we went back and we looked at all of our things that we had done in the past to see if there's other things we should have done, should have caught, and there was a good deal of review and work done by the people in the medical area in the psychological and psychiatric screening to see if there were more things that they could factor into their evaluation process. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it a major change. It was just a relook to make sure we were doing all the right things and to see if we had missed anything that we should have been doing.
Okay. From your personal background, what's your background that qualifies you for this particular job, if I can ask?
That's a good question. I'm basically oil field trash. I grew up in the oil patch up in Oklahoma. And when I was going to high school and going to college, it would never even occur to me to apply for a job for NASA because I thought that was a whole different kind and level of people. But as it turns out, NASA is just people just like any other people. They just happen to have a common goal and, you know, have the opportunity to work on one of mankind's greatest adventures. And so what got me into the actual selection process, I'm a human resources, a personnel guy. And so at the center here, we have some major organizational elements, one of those being the Flight Crew Operations Director, which includes the astronaut office. And because of, you know, people moving and things happening, I wound up assigned as the personnel representative for that group for a number of years. And that was in the early 70s. And when it came time to start thinking about doing a selection again, they just needed somebody to start looking at all the processes, procedures, regulations, and those kind of things to put the plan together. And I was just there. It was just blind fool luck. I was just at hand. They needed somebody to do the grunt work, and I was there, you know. Okay. And so it just evolved from that. You know, you put that together, then the first selection, you wind up, you know, helping with that, and then you get a little bit more responsibility, and then pretty soon you know, wind up kind of helping manage the whole thing.
Right, so now obviously we're in a, I guess, an uncertain patch. The future is very unclear.
We are.
The recent round of selectees, I guess they're very uncertain about what they're actually going to be doing, other than perhaps being assigned to a space station assignment.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, please, yeah.
I say, and that's what you said is absolutely true, but when we selected them, this class, that's what we told them up front. We told them up front, you know, here's what you're applying for. You're not going to fly the shuttle. We're going to be through with that. So you're applying to be a long-duration International Space Station crew member. Now, if something evolves after that and you're here, certainly you'll be available for that follow-on programs also. But I won't say the guarantee, the program we talked to them about when they were selected was International Space Station.
Right. Now, your role doesn't have anything to do with actual crew assignments. You're more involved in the selection from off the street, if you will, into the program, and then, I guess, another division or person looks after the crew assignment?
In 1994, I also picked up the job for to manage the astronaut candidate program, which is our basic training curriculum. And so once they show up and report for duty, and then for about the next 18 to 24 months, then I'm responsible for the overall management of that training function. I'm not smart enough to do any of the training. I just have to be sure it's all in there and the people who are supposed to do it, you know, are aware of it, and everybody's working together to get the program done. So I worry about them for about the first year and a half or 2 years.
Yep.
And then there's somebody else's problem.
Okay. So the actual crew selection, who decides who's going to go on which mission is somewhere else?
That's the chief of the astronaut office. And obviously we all work together. It's not us and them. You know, we're all one big happy family. They participate in the selection process, and certainly they're a big piece of what happens in the training. They know the job. They're the people who own the job. So if you got to be doing the training, it's satisfied all their requirements. Hmm. So we work together through all that. But once they get here and they start assigning people to crews, and it's the astronaut office, and their boss is the flight crew operations directorate, and then our center director, and then it even goes up to the headquarters level, just so everybody's on the same page when you make an announcement.
Just looking at the sort of the crews over the years, it seems there's some real inconsistencies. You'll get some individuals that will perhaps wait 5 more years before they get a flight, and then another 7 years for another one, while others might get 2 flights in a 12-month period. How does it work, or is it a bit of a mystery, or is it?
I don't think it's a mystery at all. Typically, the folks who have flown twice in a brief period of time, that's only happened a couple of times. One time there was a mission that they had a problem with the spacecraft, and the payload they were taking up, they couldn't go and they couldn't do what they were supposed to do. So it landed, they fixed everything, and that same crew went back again within a 12-month period. That's very, very uncommon. Very uncommon. Mm-hmm. Early on, we did a couple of flights where some of the crew members were turned around very quickly to see how fast can you turn around somebody to fly again. And how fast you can do that might work once, but you're asking an awful lot of a person and their family, you know, to keep them in that training flow continually. And, you know, you're not, if you send somebody to the funny farm, you know, you're not helping yourself in the long term. So there's a lot of that consideration too. And so part of it is skills related. You know, who do you have? Who do you need? And whose turn is it? You know.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So once an astronaut is becomes a candidate and becomes assigned or hired by NASA, do they choose whether they want to be a spacewalker or a pilot, or is it all down to what their background skills and competencies are? Or,
yeah.
Or are they told that this is what you should be doing because you're this is what.
That decision, early on in this training program that I mentioned, the basic training program, we try to give everybody the basic skills. Well, what's the difference? With the shuttle program, you have a group of people that were the pilots. They flew the vehicle. Those were military pilots, typically military test pilots by background. And then you have medical doctors, scientists, and engineers who make up the rest of the crew, and we call those folks mission specialists. And so within the mission specialist category, you train everybody with some basic EVA skills, some basic robotic skills, you know, some other things. And then some people, they're just people. I mean, they're just like everybody else. Some people are better at some things than others. So that doesn't mean everybody's going to be a world-class spacewalker or a world-class robotics operator. But they might be one and not the other. So there's a place for a lot of people. Getting on down to space station and having folks up for long duration, then you get to the point you really need people who can do all of it, you know. And what you assign them to do, hopefully they will have the skills to do. But if they don't, they won't. If you're too small to fit in the spacesuit and you can't do a spacewalk, then you better not do a spacewalk, you know. So there's some considerations like that. But you don't make those determinations when they walk in the door. You don't say, okay, you're a spacewalker, you're robotics, you're something else, you know.
Right.
You get them all through the training and then you assign them as you need them based on the mission requirements and their capabilities.
Right. So being from Australia, of course, our favourite son is Andy Thomas, and he's had several flights.
A great guy. Has been on the selection board and worked with Andy a lot. He was the deputy chief of the astronaut office for quite a while, so
okay.
I've worked with Andy. He's a great guy. I like him a lot.
Is he still, I've lost track, is he still currently mm-hmm. in the astronaut office? Mm-hmm. He is. Okay. Right. So he's not assigned to a shuttle mission because there's only a couple left and those have already been assigned. He's still in the astronaut office and helping with, what's he doing?
Well, all the astronauts have technical assignments where they're working across the programs doing a variety of things. And they don't do the same thing all the time. They'll do it for a year or two or three and then they'll rotate to something else. And that helps, helps broaden their base and makes them more capable. So what Andy's doing right now today, I don't know. You know, I keep up with the technical assignments a little bit, but not completely. If I ran into him, I'd say, what are you working on these days?
Right.
So I can't answer the question. I don't know what he's doing today.
Sure. Well, it's a big organization and, mm-hmm. and you
know. There's a lot of programs, a lot of things going on.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Dwayne Ross, thank you for joining us on the Space Show. It's been a real pleasure to meet you and talk with you, and thanks again.
Thank you for stopping by and let me chat with you.
My pleasure.
That was Peter Owood in conversation with Dwayne Ross, the manager of astronaut candidate selection and training at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. My, how things have changed since the days of John Glenn.